Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. And of course, if this is your first time listening or you just recently found us, thanks so much for putting us in your ears. And get in touch with us on social at IT Women's Podcast or email us thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. Let us know what you think about this episode or about anything else you'd like us to cover. We really do love hearing from you. Today, we are exploring what it's like for women who decide not to have children.
Like a lot of child-free people, there's often a narrative that your life is either some sort of Sex in the City glamour or it's, you know, like cat lady, sad little life thing. Most people are just getting on with their lives. So like, I was just getting on with my life and I didn't intend to or really mean to write this book. It wasn't like any of my other books, but it just got to the point where I thought people won't stop mentioning this to me. They have to know that there are so many different experiences that people have with this. So I didn't feel bad about myself. I just really wanted people to shut up.
That was Caroline McGuinness there. And we're also talking about the reaction of people's families, friends, and let's be honest, complete strangers to their choice to remain child-free. So we have three brilliant women on to talk about this. It seems like each generation has more child-free women than the one before. And it also seems there are more and more books, social media accounts, podcasts targeted at this growing audience. A few books recently include Ruby Warrington's Women Without Kids, Peggy O'Donnell Heffington's Without Children. There's also a book called The Lives of Childless Women by Irish-based Brazilian writer Nicola Louie, published by Dialogue Books. Now, I mentioned Caroline McGuinness there. She's on the podcast today, and she wrote in a recent Irish Times article that when she was writing her book, Harpy, A Manifesto for Child-Free Women, she talked about reconciling herself to being child-free. I went to meetups, I talked openly, I connected with other people, and it's transformed how I see myself and others who, whatever their circumstances, have been so open to hearing more. I don't have children and I never will, and I wouldn't change that for the world. I just hope we can be more decent to each other in the ways that we discuss our lives. In an age where reproductive rights are under threat across the world, it's never been more important to hear these voices. Now, just to say, we're very aware of the challenges many women face in trying to get pregnant and have babies, the fertility issues. We've covered this a lot on the podcast over the years because it is a really big and important subject. But today, we are talking to those women about their decision to remain child-free by choice, or in one case, who are just ambivalent about parenthood. Sometimes it can feel as though we are immersed in an ideological system in a society that assumes procreation, reproduction, is a duty or at least an inevitability, and it teaches that womanhood equals motherhood, which of course for many, many people is not the case. As an article I read in Psychology Today puts it, our culture steers women from day one of their lives towards motherhood. Despite all the gains women have made, they still face enormous pressure and expectations to become mothers. A child-free woman is often viewed as unnatural or selfish, and it is typically assumed that something went wrong over the course of her life that caused her to turn her back on her reproductive destiny. Many child-free women feel stigmatized, misunderstood, and alone. And some women choose to have children not out of desire, but out of fear. Fear of missing out, fear of social isolation, fear of stigma, or fear of being alone in old age. So we on the Women's Podcast thought this was a good idea for a discussion, and we invited Caroline McGuinness on to talk about this important subject. Originally from Portadown, County Armagh, she has published widely on literature and culture from the North, with a focus on women's writing, contemporary fiction and popular culture. Also joining her today is Margaret O'Connor, the host of podcast Our Kids For Me. Margaret has been working as a counsellor and psychotherapist since 2011, and her website is ourkidsforme.ie. She offers online sessions for people wondering if parenthood is right for them. And women's podcast regular Laura Kennedy is a writer and former Irish Times beauty columnist, and now she writes frequently for the Irish Times about her life and adventures in Australia, most recently about her quest to find a spice bag in Australia. Now, in Caroline's book, Harpy, A Manifesto for Child-Free Women, she says, "Not having kids wasn't a decision at all. It was a conviction deep in my bones. So I began by asking Caroline when she first knew she didn't want children."
Yeah, so I think when you're in your 20s and possibly early 30s, you think this might still happen. This might be something that I might want. You always hear about people get to a certain point in their 30s and that's what they think about all of a sudden. Certainly, I've had a lot of friends who've went down that path when that maybe wasn't on the cards for them a year beforehand. So I wasn't dead set against it, but it wasn't ever something that occurred to me. And it strikes me that people who want to have children really want them. They go through painful rounds of IVF. It has a toll financially on their careers. And I waited and waited to want that. And just the call never came.
Yes, the call never came. And when the call never came, did you feel anyway, what's wrong with me? Because society, as we know, puts women in a situation where it's not even really a question. It's what we're expected to do. We have wombs. We need to use them, which I think is a lot behind a lot of people's sort of conviction that they need to have children. Well, I'm not saying that's totally why, but I think society and over centuries, that's what we've been kind of groomed almost to be. So what did you feel about yourself when you realised that call wasn't coming?
Yeah, I think it was more the messages that you get in society from the sort of questions that you get asked. You know, quite often you get asked why, you get told you'll change your mind. And when people ask why, you know, no one says to, you know, any of my mother friends with their two beautiful children, why did you have them? You know, looking down on them like, what on earth are you thinking? People do ask you why so much. And what they're essentially asking is either what's wrong with you is sometimes the implied thing, or what went wrong in your life. And quite often the answer for some people, the answer for me isn't painful at all. I have a very good relationship with my family. I also have to say that because they're massive Irish Times readers, and my mom listens to this podcast, so I think I have to say that as well. But I just got the message that when I would be at work events, when I would be at things, and people would be like, oh, why? And they wouldn't stop. And the opening anecdote in the book is someone who just kept asking me why at a work event, and then finally switched on to the you'll change your mind narrative, which people so often say to grown women in their, you know, in their mid-30s, who obviously have thought about it. Like, we've all thought about it. We all get the messages that we need to think about it by a certain date. But you just get so much of the message, you know, you're not like us, and why aren't you like us? I just got it. Like a lot of child-free people, there's often a narrative that your life is either, you know, some sort of Sex in the City glamour, or it's, you know, like cat lady, sad little life thing. Most people are just getting on with their lives. So like, I was just getting on with my life, and I didn't intend to or really mean to write this book. It wasn't the sort of like any of my other books, but it just got to the point where I thought, people won't stop mentioning this to me. They have to know that there are so many different experiences that people have with this. So I didn't feel bad about myself. I just really wanted people to shut up. So I thought, I'll write a book and I'll wave that at them whenever they next ask me a question.
You have to keep a copy about your person at all times.
Yeah.
because you never know when they might strike on the bus.
All
they
the
could
time.
Be anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, there clearly is nothing wrong with the choice not to have children. In fact, for many people, it's a very sensible decision. It feels very right to them. Can we talk a little bit more before I move on to Margaret and Laura about why that is? Because I think you hit on something there. There's a sense of we're all doing it. What makes you different? Why are you not getting in on this thing? Yeah. I think that's behind a lot of the kind of queries. This idea that you're missing out and fundamentally there's something you're not joining in this human experience that we've been told is what we're supposed to do. Do you think that is a big part of it, or am I kind of exaggerating?
I think one of the things that has struck me is how like culturally different the expectations are for women in different societies. So I interviewed 55 women in the course of writing this book. I interviewed, I didn't do it very academically. It's not an academic book. I just sort of happened upon people and invited them, and then people told people, and that's where it went. But I found that, for example, the pressures among Irish women seemed more acute than people elsewhere. I find that a lot of it depended on like class, faith background. So I think the way that people had dealt with that stigma also depended on like the resources they had available to them. So I had some people who they really felt it amongst their family. Then I had someone else who I asked my interviewees about work, and she said, well, no one dares say anything to me because I'm the boss. And then a few weeks ago, I did an interview on the BBC with Jo Good, who doesn't have children herself. And she was like, she had never really felt a lot of stigma in her life because she moved, you know, the circle she moved in, the way that she'd been raised. So it struck me that some people are really getting it. They're getting those messages all the time. It's incessant with friends and family. And then there were other people who, through, you know, sort of luck and whatever else, just didn't feel that as much. And I wanted to kind of reflect both of those experiences. Mm. My experience was basically of getting the messages culturally, sort of understanding I was a bit different, but never having any stigma from my family. So I really needed to go and speak with women who had been ostracized, alienated, really felt very alone. So I think if the book has one message, it's that the experience of not having children is very different for different women.
And I mean, also the experience of being human. And this is what I think is, you know, this is what I think is hilarious about people. This so many times in so many circumstances, if something's happened to us, we think, oh, it should have happened to the other person. It's like not being able to put yourself in other people's shoes and realize that people have different wants and needs and ideas of what makes a fulfilled life. And that's OK. And we don't need to be up in their business.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like for friends of mine who are mothers or carers, like no one's polite about their life decisions either. They're never doing it right. They're never, you know, did they have their kids at the right time? Do they discipline them? This, that and the other. Like it's strikes me that my partner of nearly 10 years, he doesn't get any of this. No one, he's had one comment his whole life about it. So it strikes me that it's just, you know, it's all about women's decisions and what they choose to do, really. So in a way, like, it's not just that people without children have been massively stigmatized, it's that women are dealing with this across the board, I think.
But what's brilliant now, similar to sort of the menopause conversation, which, of course, never was spoken about for a long, long time, barely. And now we can't turn on the radio or open a newspaper without reading about it. It's everywhere. And I think it's fantastic the way, like your book and many, many other books, are putting this conversation out there. And Laura will be talking later about sort of ambivalence towards it, not making a decision, which is also another valid place to be. But your book is also brilliant because it talks about, like, what next for those women who make that choice to know? What does life look like? What are the choices? How do you build a life without children, which is, you know, a very rich one, which as you have yourself. We're going to talk about that later, but I'm going to move on to Margaret. Margaret, you have helped people who are in similar situations or advise them or give them, you know, or create a community of them. But did you always know you didn't want children, or like Caroline, was it a gradual decision?
Was it a bit of both, I think, and there's a piece that it can be quite abstract for a while. So when you're younger, or certainly my generation, you know, the message was, Jesus, don't get pregnant, you know, up to a certain point, whatever else happens. And then it kind of, you know, you're a bit neutral for a while, and then it kind of switches, you know, you hit 30 and then it's like socially acceptable. So I suppose when I was younger, it was like, oh, well, that's very far away and that's not something I'm interested in. And, you know, there was very little risk of it happening anyway, so it wasn't an issue. And then when I got older, I guess it became a more definite, you know, this was actually a decision I had to make. Was this something I wanted or not? And I think clients, you know, the clients that I work with would relate to that a lot. So, and again, I think, as is reflected in Caroline's book, there's this assumption it will happen later. You know, you'll do all these things later when you're a proper adult, whenever that is. And then, you know, people get to a point where, oh, OK, I'm supposed to be doing this now. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if I want to, or I don't know if I can, or I don't know if the context is right. So I suppose I see, you know, I really, really love Caroline's book because I think she just, it's so relatable. And I just, yeah, I can't wait for people to be able to read it and go, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's me. You know, I was doing that a lot during the book. I was like, yes, I've been in those conversations, or I've heard, you know, clients talk about the impact of those kinds of scenarios. So yeah, we get a lot of conflicting messages. You know, there's a very narrow window for when this is an acceptable thing to do. And then you're really supposed to do it and not question it. But at other times, you know, like Caroline says, you're trying not to, I suppose, go against the norms and the rules, which change quite regularly.
And so without, I hope it's not an annoying question, but when you made that decision, or when you didn't want to, did you have very solid reasons? Was it like, I don't want to because X, Y, and Z? I didn't really get into it there with Caroline. She described it as not feeling that calling that seemed to come to her, some of her female friends. What was it for you?
Yeah, it'd be very similar, to be honest. It just, like, I know this sounds flippant, it just wasn't on my list of priorities. There was a lot of other things I wanted to do. And yeah, it just never got to the top of the, I don't know if it was ever really on the list, but it certainly never got to the top of the list. And again, you know, like Caroline says, this is not something people don't think about, you know, and it's not something that, you know, I would often say to clients, like, you've done all these other things. It's not that you're like, don't want to do hard things, or you just, you know, are lazy, or just, you know, oh, I don't know about that. You know, people, I guess it's always interesting to look at, what do you commit to? What do you make happen in your life? What do you work towards? And I suppose my focus was just always on other things. It wasn't on that. So I suppose I had to look at that and go, why is that really? Yeah.
And then as Caroline was kind of discussing, when she talks about the anecdote at the start of her book where, you know, she's being badgered by this person at a work event about, you know, why she's made that choice. And there's this sense always, I think, that people with children usually assume that the person is going to regret this decision, which is so, I feel, patronizing and kind of like not something, again, that gets maybe said to men, or basically that doesn't get said to us about a lot of other things that we do. But for some reason, people feel they're allowed to have an opinion on this, and that they're able to tell you that actually you're wrong. The decision you've made is actually wrong. And it's kind of amazing and mind blowing, because in any other context, it would be kind of really rude to do that. But in this way, it's not. Talk to me a bit about that. Have you had it a lot?
Oh, yeah, I could. I could talk for days about this. But and because, I mean, look, and I know it is something, you know, you can laugh about. But again, I know clients who have been really impacted.
Sorry, when you say clients, tell me about the context of
Sarah,
that.
Yeah, so I'm a psychotherapist, so I work with clients. So my clients will kind of be between, say, people who are really, really unsure and they're stuck in that ambivalence that Laura is probably going to talk about. And then also people who are, I'm going to say, 80, 90, 100% sure that they don't want kids and are not sure that next step, what do I do with this? So that's, you know, and it's general therapy. I'm just, you know, helping people work through that. But people are really impacted. And it is that piece of, you know, thinking of someone in particular who, you know, very conscientious, very reflective, very, you know, responsible. And they're meeting this person who they've never met before at a work dinner, like so similar to Caroline's story, who feels entitled to go on for like 20 minutes and interrogate them in front of all these other people during dinner about, like, well, have you thought about this and have you thought about that? And not accepting the person's answer. Like, yes, I have thought about this for years. I've read the books, I've listened to the podcasts, I've gone to therapy. This is where I am. And you, whoever you are, feel entitled to tell me that I am wrong and this is unacceptable. And you're going to be sad and alone, and, you know, and it is, it's mind boggling that this is an acceptable commentary. And it's not unusual. That's the difficult thing. Yeah. I think it's getting better, but it's still, yeah, happens too often, in my opinion.
And what about you personally? You've talked about clients, but mm-hmm. have you experienced it as well? And what kind of is your way of dealing with it?
Yeah. In the past, not anymore. I think anyone who knows me gets that's a pointless conversation. I think you have to I suppose my suggestion would be, I think you have to gauge how you're feeling and the context that you're in. Sometimes you're in the mood to kind of have that conversation and you know, maybe address what's happening. And other times you just want to, you know, not, you know, and it's that piece of, well, why do I have to justify this? Because actually it doesn't impact anybody else. Like, it literally just impacts you and whoever else might be involved in that decision. If there is somebody, it doesn't involve the stranger at the bus, or, I mean, even your wider family to a degree. They're not living your life. They're not the ones who's going to be pregnant and have the baby and, you know, be responsible for that child for the rest of your life. So I think there's a bit around figuring out whose business is this, who is worth your time and your effort. Sometimes there can be really positive conversations, because sometimes people are genuinely curious because it literally hasn't occurred to them and they're actually interested. And that's a very different conversation to, I will not accept this no matter what you say. So there's a bit of figuring out, yeah, context and your own resources on the day as to how much of that you want to get into.
Yeah, fair enough. Your website and podcast is called Our Kids for Me. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the fact that you help clients with these issues. Why did you decide to go into it? Was it based out of your own experience?
Yeah, because, and I mean, things have grown so much, and this is why I am so excited about Caroline's book, because it's in an Irish context. You know, this choice is not new and people have been doing it for a long time. But I think there's been this sense that, oh, you know, people in America or people somewhere else, you know, not like me are doing this. So, yeah, it was really just to try and create a space like, this is very normal. And, you know, people come and they have anxieties about having children and they still decide to go ahead and have children. I'm not trying to convert anybody, you know, or stop anybody doing anything they want. I always feel the need to say that, because I think it's perfectly reasonable to have some anxieties. It's a huge thing to do. And it's such a difficult to predict. Nobody knows how it's going to be for you, pregnancy, birth, child. So I think it's really reasonable to have some concerns and address those. So it's just really trying to create a space, because it's so hard to find an objective space. Everybody has an opinion, which is fine. But when you're in that unsure space, or when you think, oh, I don't know if anybody else is having these kind of questions, or anybody else wants to live a life like what I'm thinking about, I just think an objective space is so important. And the resources, you know, as I said, things have improved. There's so many podcasts and now books, and they're fantastic. And they're all, we need them all, precisely because of what Caroline has said. There's no one way of doing this. Equally, like, the parenting experience is so different. Being child-free or not having children is a very, very individual experience. Which on the one hand is great, but is also quite scary, because we like having templates. So the more stories we can get out there, the better. So that's really the reason.
Yeah, the more experiences. And I think it comes back to what Caroline said as well. I think women just get it in the neck for whatever decisions they make, deciding to have children, you know, following certain parenting guides or rules or whatever they do. But a lot of the time we end up being sort of wrong and being told about it by a lot of people. Laura, I want to come to you all the way over there in the Southern Hemisphere in Canberra, Australia. You are, as Margaret sort of alluded to earlier, some of her clients are kind of have an ambivalence or are in sort of the undecided camp around this. And you've written about this in your Substack, Peak Notions, in a column that you called "The Window Closes, Dispatches from Inside, a Narrowing Fertility Gap." So where are you now in terms of your thoughts and feelings around being a parent?
Well, I wrote that piece originally about a year or more ago. So I think if you remain ambivalent long enough, it becomes a decision. It coalesces into a decision. And people might say, well, that's for biological reasons or whatever. But perhaps the one of the indicators, I think, of women who are not necessarily interested in a traditional route in relation to this question is, I've noticed there are others who kind of think, well, even if I had a child, why should it necessarily be genetically my child? You know, I can't personally think of a good reason why I need to make a person. There are lots who need a nice place to stay. And so if I wanted to go down that route, I think that might be a better route for me. But yeah, I mean, my ambivalence has always been quite a languorous ambivalence. And I think in some ways that in itself invites judgment and irritation from both sides of the very riven battlefield of motherhood. The sort of pronatalist versus antinatalist corners, everybody wants you to pick a side, dig down with them, and kind of accept this idea that there's nothing worth having if you took the other route. You know, those people are wrong. They've made a bad decision. And obviously, I think the vast majority of people on either side, mothers and non-mothers, elective and non-elective, are just reasonable human beings being alive. But especially when it comes to the kind of wider cultural media and online discourse around this stuff, you always get the extreme views kind of being the loudest. And those are the ones that tend to follow women around.
Yeah. You're married. I just let people know. Are you kind of as a married woman, do you face the question, when are you having kids, often? Or do you think people are more informed now and realize that that's not necessarily a kind of polite question to ask? Do you get that question?
I get it. Yeah, I get the question. I get it a little bit less often now that I kind of cut ties with everyone I know and moved to Australia. That's a solution for any women looking for it. If you leave all your family and friends behind, nobody can ask you. They have to WhatsApp it, and that's just objectively rude. But I get people at, you know, like at dinner parties or a function where you don't really know anybody. And you know what? I think there's something worth discussing that in a secular context, at least in my experience, the question asker is always a woman. I've never been asked this by a man.
Oh, that's interesting, because I think the person that Caroline was talking about earlier was a man who was very much interrogating her on it. So there are some men who are fascinated by it. But yeah, I see what you mean. Women sort of almost wanting to know, what the heck? Why are you not doing that? Or why have you not made a decision on this?
Yeah, I think there's there's a kind of a maternal angle to it. I think sometimes there's older women where obviously motherhood has been so very meaningful to them that they kind of want to save you from missing out on something that they really think is integral to human experience. And so it's kind of kindly meant, but in this very probing, demanding, uncomfortable way. And especially if you're in a kind of a group scenario with a bunch of people you don't know, which is invariably where it tends to happen to me, or some woman I don't know will sort of march up with a pair of salad tongs and demand to know that I haven't, you know, made a new human being. I'm like, who are you again? But yeah.
No. And in your column, you say that you're kind of struck by how binary this discussion is in the media around this issue, like this do or don't. And that, you know, where you are with that ambivalence, there isn't so much nuanced conversation, like it's quite polarized.
I think so. I mean, I hate the conversation and I hate being involved in the conversation. Like, this is such a timely...
Well, thank you for coming on the podcast.
that's the thing. Since I wrote that Substack article, I think I've had like 4 or 5 different requests to talk about it in context, because in media context in Ireland, because there aren't, as you guys know, that many people talking about it. And every time I say no, because I know it's going to be basically, here's 4 minutes in between ads for tires, justify your life choices. And so when you guys asked, I was like, all right, well, Roisin's kind and sane, so we'll have a nuanced conversation.
And we don't have any ads for tires or anything else. But yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's like, we'll give Laura a couple of minutes to say why her crazy idea not to have children, you know, why she feels like that way. But then we'll talk to people who really love their children and think it's, you know, that Laura's missing out. It'll be this kind of debate thing.
Yes, then what's sort of at question in the centre of that is basically your life. And I think what's often missing from this conversation in public is we don't really talk in a nuanced way about how, and I'm perfectly happy for anyone to make any choice that's good for them. And, you know, I can totally see the value and the meaning in motherhood, even if I can't see the value in it for me. But we don't talk about the fact that, say, motherhood now looks very different to motherhood 20 years ago in Ireland or anywhere else. We don't talk about the fact that it used to be, there was a time, for better or worse, when it was a kind of a communal enterprise. Now we live in a very fragmented sort of nuclear family society where, for example, somebody like me, I live in Australia with my husband. I don't have any friends or family here. If I did commit to raising a child here, I would be doing nothing but that for the next 20 years. That would be it for me. There's no help. There's no kind of safety net. There's no community. So that's not an attractive prospect to me.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. You also feel that the conversation on every side has a sort of snarky and frenzied tone. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, it's certainly not everybody, but I often find when people kind of ask me about this choice, what they're doing is they're filtering my choice through theirs. They're feeling judged by what I am doing or what I am not doing. And they're seeking to kind of either defend or endorse themselves, their life and their choice. And the reality is ultimately that, and I mean it in a kind way, I don't care about their choice. You know, I support their choice. Great. I'm so glad that you are doing what you wanted to do. I see the validity in that. But I don't care, as in I don't have shares in your decision and you don't have them in mine. But it can often feel, as a woman who kind of doesn't have children once you get to a certain point, there's a bit of a hangdog. Oh, you know, there must be something going on there. So she cannot fulfill her biological destiny. You know, her womanhood can never reproduce anything beyond itself. And therefore it is always failed and incomplete. And those people kind of pity you, but they also stay away from you a little bit in case it's catching. So there is that sense of that what you have chosen to do in some way poses a threat to what they have chosen to do. And so what you get then is this incredibly polarized conversation where someone is asking you why you've done something, but actually what they're doing is justifying why they've done something. And you kind of feel a bit kicked around like a football in a conversation. You know, you've become a means to someone else's end, to justifying their choice or finding meaning in their own life. And you're just sitting there going, I forget your surname. We just met. What's happening?
Yeah. Listen, I want to come back to Caroline. Thank you very much for that, Laura.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We talked earlier, Caroline, about you were interested in the book, in your manifesto for child-free women, about not so much why women weren't having children, more about the what next and the type of lives that can be lived. Tell me more about that and why you're interested in that aspect.
Yeah, so I was really struck by what Laura was saying about finding those arguments very polarizing. And I find those kind of arguments really kind of really polarizing myself. I'm sort of quite a reluctant poster girl for this decision. I don't even know how I feel about the word child free a lot of the time.
Okay.
I don't even know how I feel about the term or, you know, a lot of the content online, all of that sort of, I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it. So, which is part of the reason why I wanted to hopefully add a bit of nuance and a bit of complexity into some of these conversations. And the thing that I was interested in was a lot to do with what Laura was saying as well, which is how women live their lives after kind of committing to this path. So we may not say, I'm also not entirely sure about like decision, because as we've sort of all discussed, like it isn't necessarily like you sit down with your coloured pens and you're like, you know, pros and cons and then you add them all up. It's not necessarily, you know, so whenever people kind of come to this like realisation and whatever it looks like, what do they do next? So I also felt that I had to interview women who were older and to find out what it was about their lives. I wanted to interview people just to find out how they had managed. And what I found was, as sort of Margaret alluded to, no one really expressing any regret. I found people who had lots of hobbies. I had found people who, one thing that they seemed to be, that a lot of the older women seemed to be experts on, was after their friends' kids had flown the nest, then their friends came to them like, what do we do now? Like, what do we do with our lives now? So they were sort of experts on how to kind of pass the time, which was great. But the concern that was kind of real and vivid for me was the question that's also asked, like, who'll look after you when you get older? That question and that part. And also questions around like loneliness and isolation. And as I said, the people experience really varying degrees of that. So obviously the who look after you when you're older, peace depends a lot on, you know, people's jobs, people's resources. You know, that was very, very different and very varied. And for me, the really complex question was the loneliness one. And it's not exclusively people who don't have children who are lonely. We all know people who are desperately lonely in new motherhood. We know people of all sorts. So what it struck me was that, as Laura was saying about the sort of the very atomized way that our society is, there is a social problem around loneliness that affects everyone at all walks of life, at all stages. But what I did see in the child-free women that I interviewed was that they are, and there's been studies on this, they are better integrated into their communities. They tend to do more volunteering because obviously, you know, they're, you know, not raising their kids. And they seem to actually have time to get out and about and do things. But like I said, that all just depends on, you know, their status in life, you know, whether they're partnered or not. There was just so many different factors. But what I did find was just a lot of women who didn't have children just like rolling their sleeves up and making new friends and having friends at every stage of life. There were some people who, you know, stayed friends with their mates with kids throughout their lives, and that changed and adapted and was fluid. One thing I found really inspirational was there was a friend of mine who is sort of, she's a lesbian and all her friends are as well. And they're sort of part of a collective where, you know, someone will mind someone's baby when they're, you know, and then someone will look after someone when they're not well. And there was much more of a sense of community within their group. So I really sought out those places where people found and were creative about how they would find community with other people. I find that really exciting and really hopeful.
Mm. And speaking of all the different, you kind of in the book, you look at people who are experiencing things in their home, in the family, yeah, maybe at work, yeah, and the different things. And one woman you spoke to discussed how her child-free life was a subject of painful discussion at every, yes, family event, yes, that she went to. Yeah. But what was your own experience like? Because your mother's really supportive, and yeah, that sort of stereotype that every mother of someone who decides not to have children is going to be appalled isn't really necessarily true, is it?
No, and she always told me, like, whatever you do in life, I just want you to be happy. It was always what she told me when I was growing up. And I'm an only child as well. So there is a bit more of a, you know, you feel like my partner, his brother has kids. So that's sort of us off the hook on that side of the family, you know. But there was always just, yeah, there was always just support. But I just really knew that really hadn't been the experience for a lot of people. So in a way, like, so I want to say this to people when they start reading the book. So it starts off by talking about like people's family of origin and the culture, like Irish culture and what it sort of, what it does to people. It gets gradually happier and more hopeful as we go through the book. So I don't want people to get put off. Like there has to be a lot of stuff. There's also, you know, a lot of stuff also about like reproductive rights around the world, because I know that, you know, in the UK and in Ireland at the moment, people can still make that choice. And it is, you know, like, you know, whether or not, you know, if they get pregnant, you know, to make that choice. But I had a lot of interviewees from the southern states in America, from other countries where they can't make those decisions, you know, kind of anymore if they want to stay child free. So, yeah, it just struck me that I really just wanted to hear from people who had different experiences to mine, even if they were a bit painful and a bit challenging.
Yeah. And the other thing you write about is this expectation that all women should become mothers, and how, going back to what Laura was saying, there's a sort of an Irish cultural, yeah, thing to that in Ireland, traditions of family and childbearing. I think you'd write, weighty ties to the idea of the nation, almost like it's your patriotic duty to reproduce.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And the rather, that's also a real expectation within the Jewish community. There was various women have been interviewed around that. Women from African American communities, women from, you know, kind of other kind of communities of faith. There was a real sense that, you know, you're letting the side down, you're letting, you know, the tribe down. You're not fulfilling this role that we expect from you, like on a much grander level. And I know that I actually have a PhD student who's nearly finished at the moment, who's working on the mother figure in contemporary Irish literature, so I'm reading about this all the time. But it just struck me that we know the way these messages, you know, culturally circulate. We know, with the, you know, kind of the amendment to the constitution, like we know the way that people talk about the role of mothers within Irish society, and that it has a different, you know, kind of complexion that is tied to like faith and nation. And obviously I come from the north, and there's, you know, like I remember when I was growing up, that was around the same time that, you know, Ian Paisley was describing Catholic women as incubators for the Vatican. So you felt very much like your body wasn't your own, that your body could be kind of put in service of, you know, kind of of your people. So the idea that there are women who see all of that and feel that overwhelming pressure and say, actually, no, you're grand, I think really speaks to how sincerely felt their convictions are. Because you wouldn't be able to still refuse it despite all that pressure if you didn't know that was what you didn't want.
Yeah. And Margaret, Caroline also talks a lot about friendships and how friendships change when friends begin to have babies. And for many women she interviewed, they had to sort of remake their friendship circles and you know, find friends that are sort of at similar places to them. What's your experience been like that? And also to Laura as well.
I think it's interesting. I think, you know, we know people that there's more flexibility, I guess, in life. A lot of the time we end up doing the same things, but we might do them in a slightly different order, or you might have more choice, like, okay, you might decide not to get married, or you might decide to get married later or have a civil partnership or whatever it is. Or, you know, you can move other things around. There's more flexibility. And so it makes you feel connected to your friend group. This is one thing that you're either doing or you're not. And that sense of, okay, I'm going to be different now. You know, they're all going on this path and where am I going to be? It can be really, really difficult for people. And it can be challenging. You know, we know, again, and that's no criticism of parents, they're just busy. They're sleep deprived at particular points of life. And we know as well that friendships come back around. You know, that there's light at the end of the tunnel. But for the person who doesn't have children, you're like, right, what am I going to do for, you know, the next 5 to 8 years, you know, so you're like, right, I need, you know, it's about creating your own support networks. It's like what Caroline said, like, if you know that's your situation, it's not like it kind of comes at you as a surprise. You know that this is going to happen. So it does, I think it does involve a bit more proactivity. It does involve a bit more work. You do kind of have to, you know, go out and find your people or find the activities that work for you. But I really like, Caroline talks about like that renegotiation piece. Like there's no point thinking a friendship is not going to change if somebody in that friendship has a child. It just will. But that can be renegotiated, you know, but I guess it takes, you know, it takes self-awareness, it takes communication, it takes patience on both sides and some flexibility. So I think it's really important to reflect on that. There's no point thinking, well, everything's going to be the exact same, because it can't be. It doesn't need to be. But for the child-free person, yeah, I think it's really important not to feel, I suppose it's, again, as Caroline said, it's very context specific. If you feel, well, I'm the only person in my group not doing this one thing, whatever that is, you know, it won't feel great. Whereas if you can then say, okay, well, I have these friends, you know, we tend to have kind of different friend groups. You have these friends who are doing these, but I also have, you know, this other group of friends, and they don't have to be separate. But I know that when those people are busy, I have other people to link in with, whether that's through, you know, it could be social media forums or meetup groups or people that you happen to meet in your own life. But I think it's about fostering those networks. It's a really important piece so that you don't end up feeling isolated. And then kind of the stigma or the questioning then comes in of, well, why am I the only person here? It's so important to have like-minded people in your community.
And Laura, what about you? What have you found in terms of friendships? Is that something that you are mindful of?
I am, but I try, and this is both maybe optimistic and deeply pessimistic. So sorry for that, because we're having such a nice, gentle conversation. But in one way, I think what's nice to remember is that this is very much like any other major life change that anyone goes through, like a death, a new job, emigrating, having a baby, whatever. They change and their needs change. And as a person without children, I'm conscious that I might not be the friend most needed by my friend when they've just had a baby, or, you know, when they're deep in the depths of that, they may feel that there's more to offer from a friend in a similar situation. And as Margaret said, you know, it comes back around and it changes. But so I think when those big life changes happen, you do lose people, you have a reshuffle, things look different in terms of your kind of social life. But I think part of the issue is there's so much judgment that comes in when you are, or at least, you know, I think for Irish women, we can generalize in that sense. There's so much judgment that comes in that it can feel a bit as though you're almost not entitled to build a kind of a social existence outside that norm. And it exists, it's there. And you know, I think it's only healthy to try and explore different kinds of friendship. Because if everyone around you is a new mother, that's such an intense, important experience. And ultimately, the reality is, it's one to which you cannot currently relate. And so, you know, maybe the friendship is not the ideal friendship in that moment for both people.
Yeah, fair enough. Let's talk about role models, because, you know, in popular culture, if we look at sort of Bridget Jones and I'm going to Cruella de Vil, Annie Wilkes in Misery, there's some very, you know, or that thing that you said earlier, Caroline, about Cat Lady or somebody with loads of cats and all that kind of thing. It's not exactly the nice stereotypes. Child-free women or childless women are demonized in literature and various popular cultures. So is it important that there are positive child-free role models? Is that something that you're all interested in and that you look at?
Yeah, so as you say, like in the book, I have one chapter about all those kind of like bad, negative representations. And I seem to find that like lots of them involve, this is a strange thing to say, but lots of them involve like unnatural behaviour and animals and like cruelty towards children. I'm thinking about like, Trunchbull and Matilda. And they're always, or like Marge Simpson's two sisters, you know, and their Pettigwana. Or as you say, like a lot of people getting eaten by cats as well. All this, you know. So there seem to be a lot of these representations that obviously reflect the anxieties that people have around people who, you know, won't fit in or don't fit in. You know, Miss Havisham, you know, in Ireland, you know, there's a novel by Molly Keane called Good Behaviour that's about the spinster daughter of the house, and she's monstrous as well. So it's always a sense of being quite kind of animalistic, monstrous and cruel in these dominant cultural representations. But what the thing that blew my mind as I was thinking about it was the representations that I had gravitated towards had all been in music. They'd all been in women who were in music. They'd all been, Debbie Harry, Dolly Parton, PJ Harvey, Florence the Machine, Self Esteem, Fleetwood Mac, both women in Fleetwood Mac, you know, without children, really sort of with a really good friendship. And I realised that all of the music that I liked had been written by, and I know, I think it was like Lily Allen was recently talking about how hard it had been for her to stay as a touring musician after she had children. So there's obviously reasons that women without children can maybe stay as like touring musicians and stuff like that. But I just find in like the idea of just a really powerful woman singing, writing her own music, that to me was a place that I personally found had both creativity and enjoyment. Because sometimes, when you don't have children, you can be stereotyped as quite, you know, sour and dour and, you know, and no crack at all. But just to see people being just creative just really made me very happy.
Yeah, I love that list that you listed out there. I was just looking up Kate Bush, and she has one child, Bertie. But apparently she kept the existence of Bertie secret for 5 years, which is interesting, until Peter Gabriel accidentally announced that she had a child. But that's another story. Laura, what do you think about that? Do you care about, like, do you need positive role models? Are you happy, you know, you're happy enough in your own sort of decision or your own kind of ambivalence? You know, or do you like hearing about women who haven't done it and are living these great lives?
Do you know what? I think, for the record, I'd like to state I am sour and dour and no crack. And I think I'd still be that way if I had I'd be worse if I had many children. But I think what I really want is value neutral representation, because that's what I think. I think having children or not having them is value neutral. I am so sick of the conversation, the idea that one is valuable and one is not. And obviously that perspective shifts depending on who's doing the looking. I really would like to see more women as characters in general who are just women doing stuff, and we're not required to locate their value in the people around them, whether they've made those people or not. I just want to be sort of allowed to be. And for the most part, I am. You know, I think like women have obviously been fighting for centuries to get us to where we are now. And it's pretty great, because I don't think in Ireland 20 years ago, I could have ever lived the life that I live now. So, yeah, I think value neutral is the ideal. Just that it's not a virtuous situation to have children, and it's not virtuous not to have them. It's just neutral.
I think that's brilliantly put, Laura. Were you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, I just really like also believe in the right of like people without children to be mediocre at their jobs and to be just grand and not to have to achieve or not to have to be, you know. There's, I think it was Sarah Baum had a great article where she talked about her ordinary days. And she just talked about, like, she goes for a walk, she has a nice time, she's grand, like, she's nobody bothering her. And I think there is also often this expectation on women without children, you know, to be exceptional, to be remarkable, to do all of these things. Like when most of us are just trying to, like, you know, do our jobs, put the bins out, pay our taxes. Like we're not anybody's role model or anything else. What I wanted more to kind of highlight, and something I'm always been interested in, are like just moments and glimpses of things, you know, where you would sometimes see, you know, someone like doing their own thing, or you would sometimes see someone being creative and you would think, oh, that's for them. But then again, that person who's doing that thing, that being that creative, like a lot of their life is probably, you know, like mediocre a lot of the time as well, you know. So I think what Laura says is absolutely right. Like, because a lot of the content online is either like, look at my life, it's brilliant. And like, obviously I'm too Irish really for any of that, you know what I mean? Like, to be like, I'm fantastic. Like, and the people, and their vibe seems to be like constantly pumping out content about how like amazing it is. And that wasn't really, like, I don't know if anyone could sustain that level of existence, you know, of being constantly delighted with themselves, you know?
Yeah, I think that's really good points made by all of you. I think maybe if we could finish up by discussing about, or just letting people know, anyone listening to this who maybe just wants to kind of understand why, maybe people with children or without, who want to understand why it's not a topic of conversation that they should think is this open one that they're allowed to talk to anyone about, random people, as we said at the bus stop. Margaret, what have you learned from your clients about kind of what they wish that people knew or understood about their either ambivalence or their decision to sort of remain child-free?
Yeah, I think that they have thought about it. This is not something they have not spent hours and hours and weeks and years thinking about. So to respect that, it's not that they can't be, you know, it's not that they're beyond question, but I think it's the tone and the timing and, you know, do you really need to know that about this person? I would just maybe invite people to think about that, you know. Can you ask about something else? I think there's a lot of it that's just habit and I'm going to say maybe laziness. It's you know, it's an easy thing to kind of go, oh, okay, you know, if you have kids and I have kids, now we can talk about kid stuff. Whereas if you could just like ask about something else about the person, you know, you can still have a conversation if you need to make conversation in whatever context you're in. But yeah, they have thought about it, is what I would say.
That's a very good point. That yeah, you're not springing this on someone and they haven't had plenty of time.
Oh my God, thank you so much. I have not considered any of these points. I will now go and have a baby. Yeah,
exactly. And Laura, coming to you as a philosopher, I was very interested to read in the Irish Times this week, actually, about a new book called Begetting. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's by Mara van der Lucht. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her second name correctly, but she's a philosopher. And Jo Humphrey says she takes her role as a killjoy seriously. So you'll relate to that as a sour, dour woman. And she follows the logic, even if it takes you to uncomfortable places. And she asks a number of questions in relation to kind of whether you should have children or not. Things like, why would you add suffering to the world? What's so special about your genes, which you alluded to as well? So can we have a little philosophical take on this? Because I know, as someone who reads a lot of philosophy, has a PhD, who's Dr. Laura Kennedy, we should say, what's your philosophical take on this? That book sounds very interesting, by the way. It's called Begetting. It might be something you'd all be wanting to read.
It does sound interesting. Well, look, on the spot, on the hop, I don't know if I can come up with anything valuable. But
I doubt that, Laura.
As conversations go, it's one of the ones where it's always the most nuanced, complex questions that people feel the answer is obvious to. And that's why I think, in part, this is such a visceral one for a lot of people, where they just think, well, of course you have children, or, you know, of course you don't, or whatever. But the majority position is, of course you have children. But I think in the context of Irish culture, especially that question, that sort of idea about people feeling entitled to ask you the question, I think it's always useful to look at things sort of from a distance, big picture. I would say that we have very little hope of getting people to stop asking that question in Irish culture, because we have a culture that aggressively values conformity. You know, like if you turn up to a Christmas party in a long coat, someone will turn around and go, what news from the front? They have to make fun of it. They will. Like, we have to point out the hat is not the normal hat. We have to point out the behavior is not the normal behavior. And so people will continue to do that in this context too, because it's culturally ingrained within us. So I think one of the useful things sort of philosophically to do is flip that question and think, instead of how can I stop people from asking me this, how can I create conditions where I feel entitled to answer it honestly, as in to say, listen, Betty, get out of my face, or I don't feel like talking about this right now, or that's actually an exceptionally rude question. I'm very interested in why you would ask me that at this table full of strangers. And then just quietly stare at them until they unravel. You know?
Oh my like, God.
Preserving too much of other people's comfort is a thing Irish women do. And when you're being invaded in that way, other people's comfort is not relevant. That's, yeah. Plato would say that. He wouldn't, he was very sexist, oh. But you know.
Laura, I love that. I think other people's preserving other people's comfort is in a whole other podcast, which we have to do very soon because and it does, it's the thing that is, you know, it terrorizes and persecutes a lot of women, making sure everyone feels okay about everything. It's not a good one. I want to throw out a couple of things that I was reading recently. Elon Musk, he is really concerned about underbreeding in wealthy countries, and he says feminism is to blame for it. And he's very down on birth strikers, women who have chosen not to procreate because of the climate crisis. And political leaders like Hungary's Viktor Orban have introduced financial incentives to boost baby numbers. So there's a kind of a geopolitical thing here as well, isn't there?
Yeah, but like speaking anecdotally, like a lot of friends of mine and a lot of my students as well talk about how they don't feel like they can start the family that they want to have, that they consent to have, that they are desperate to have, because they can't afford it. And I don't think the solution, like if now, whether or not, you know, we do need more children in the West, that is beyond my pay grade at the moment to work out to demographics and all the rest of it. But it is true that people who desperately want to have children cannot afford to have children in the UK and Ireland. And the solution is not to be found in people who have refused. It's in making conditions livable for everyone and making sure that women who do want to have children do not feel discriminated against in the workplace. We have a massive childcare crisis in the UK where people are paying half their salaries out to have one child in nursery. I know mothers who are paying their full salary out to have two children in nursery and then relying on their husbands for the bills. Like that is regressive and disgusting. And that needs to be fixed before we start looking at the people who don't want to have them.
Yeah. And I think it's important to say, and I know you all probably would agree, that obviously we're very conscious that there are a lot of women who, you know, like we've talked about, are desperate to have babies and for whatever reason can't. And there's very difficult infertility challenges and, like you say, financial challenges and all sorts of reasons why women who want children can't have them. And we're, you know, talking about not having children, it doesn't mean that there's no compassion for that experience. I think we'd all agree with that, wouldn't we?
It's a different path, but I think, you know, people who choose not to or people who can't end up in the same place, you know, at maybe, you know, the end of that journey, you know, so they're the people who really want to have children and can't are also impacted by all of the things we're talking about. And that's so incredibly painful for them. There is a difference, you know, and I understand that, and there should be. And people tend to be more sympathetic to a point, obviously, of people who couldn't. There's a much more harsh response to, oh, you could, but you deliberately chose not to. And that gets very different treatment. And I think even for people to say, you know, is that what I'm doing? And like, is that OK? Can I do that? Like, they're very different. But as I said, the experience kind of once that has happened, there are crossovers later on that we need to be really aware of. Yeah.
I just want to and finally kind of come to a close with Ruby Warrington's written, I'm sure you all have read it or know about it, a book called Women Without Kids. And she writes in that the only milestones women without children are allowed are seemingly menopause, retirement and death. And she suggests creating new ones that don't center on a traditional family unit. And she also says that being child-free helps her to experience life more as one long, ever-evolving moment that will bring all sorts of challenges and shifts and opportunities rather than waiting for the big events that don't really make us as happy as we think they will. So final thoughts on that?
I don't know about that now. I think some of us have sort of circumnavigated that by having a big book launch this week. So I'm having a big party this week. Thanks very much. But I don't know about that idea about like needing milestones in your life. You know what I mean? Like needing people to mark things, needing other people to tell you you're great or you're grand. Like just, you know, like, have a nice morning, have a cup of tea, get out. You know, I really do like a lot of that book, but I'm not entirely sure about that aspect of, you know, like, throwing yourself a party for a decision you didn't make. Like, I'm grand. Like, you know, I'll go out with my mates on a Saturday night. Like, I just don't know that I need any, like, special celebrations. You know, like, I'm in my 40s. Like, I'll be grand. Like,
And this is just while I'm on, because I haven't mentioned the fact that your book is called, well, yet in this conversation, Harpy. It's the Manifesto for Child-Free Women.
Yeah.
Tell me about the word harpy just briefly, so people know.
Yeah, so this is a bit of like, I felt that there were so many of these representations that were like, child-free women are scary. They're big monsters. They're coming, like PJ Harvey even says that people think that she lives in a cave and comes down to eat children. And I loved that. And I loved all of that. And I loved just basically like making fun of that. Most cultures have like scary bird women in them. Who kind of are at the edge of, you know, kind of town bearing down on people. In Ireland, we have the figure of the Morrigan, the kind of the bird goddess as well. So I just love the idea of taking this idea that is meant to be like so scary and so ridiculous. And I got the great, the publisher got the great Belfast cover designer, Anna Morrison, to do the front cover of it. And she designed this whole beast for me, but me and my publisher had a bit of an argument about whether or not she should be smiling on the front cover. And I just love the idea of this really scary looking beast, but she has a big smile on her
face. Okay, I'm glad. You know? I'm glad.
I won the argument.
Thank God.
I won the argument. So the idea of like just basically making fun of this idea that we are just so scary and so formidable when most of us are just, you know, like living our lives day to day.
Taking out the bins, paying your taxes, like you said earlier. Well, look, I have to confirm to all the listeners of the Women's Podcast that none of you look like scary bird women or anything of the type. You all look pretty normal to me, and I've just really enjoyed this conversation. I hope we have more of them. I hope there's more books, but well done on yours, Caroline, and well done on the work you do, Margaret, and continued congratulations to you, Laura, for your incredible writing on Substack and all the things that you do and in the Irish Times as well. It's been a pleasure to talk to you all. And it's just widening that conversation and allowing people to understand that there are different experiences, and that's okay. And actually, it's none of your business anyway, which is my main feeling about it all. Who cares? It doesn't affect you. So just let people, as Sinead O'Connor sang, how about I be me and you be you? And I think if people just, you know, took that on board for a lot of different subjects, we'd all be grand.
Yeah.
And that's my final word on it anyway. And it's been just such a pleasure to talk to you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Caroline McGuinness, Margaret O'Connor and Laura Kennedy there. And I just think that was a great conversation. I hope you did too. If you enjoyed this episode and the podcast, please leave us a review or subscribe to us, as it really makes a difference. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan and by me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Talk to us on social at IT Women's Podcast or email us thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's it from me. Mind yourselves, and I will talk to you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.